Welcome into another edition of Generations Radio. I'm Adam McManus, and for Kevin Swanson, a very special guest, Dinesh D'Souza, the producer of a brand new movie, Trump Card, that you can get access to at TrumpCardTheMovie.com. I urge you, having just watched it within the last half hour, you must watch this and you must make sure that you share it with your friends and family. Get the DVD, rent it online for about $4. The DVD is only about $15. TrumpCardTheMovie.com. Dinesh, you have done something that is, I believe, one of the greatest services to this country you've ever done.
Hey, I really appreciate that. I've now made 5 political documentaries, and I think this latest one, Trump Card, is the best one. It deals with the massive issue of socialism. And the movie is sort of loosely based on my book called United States of Socialism. One of the key questions I look at is, how did this crazy idea of socialism that was tried all over the world in 25 countries and collapsed everywhere in the last century, collapsed in Russia and China and India, how did this idea make a comeback in America for the first time in our history in the 21st century?
You note that socialists exploit politics of fear, and that there's literally a moral anxiety about capitalism in too much of the country, especially among millennials, college students, etc.
Yeah, I think that capitalism is understood to be an efficient way of producing wealth, but it's never been explained why capitalism is a form of social justice. In other words, capitalism appears to dispense rewards in kind of a funny way. You know, a truck driver makes $50,000 a year, but a baseball player makes millions of dollars a year. Now, how can you defend this on the basis of justice? So that's the theme I take seriously in the movie. I try to make the moral case for capitalism by showing that it allocates rewards in proportion with what people actually do to create value in the market.
You explore the issue of capitalism through the eyes of Donald Trump himself and his famous book, Art of the Deal. Tell us about that vision he had to buy a hotel that had been struggling for a rock-bottom price and turn it around.
Well, the question I'm looking at here is, what is it that entrepreneurs actually do? We pick Trump because not only is he the political general in the fight against socialism, he's also the classic capitalist. And I look at one of his early deals, which is his deal to buy the Commodore Hotel, a very, at that time, historic but rundown hotel in New York City. Now, Karl Marx, the great sort of prophet of socialism, when he used the word capitalism, what he meant is that capitalists or entrepreneurs do nothing except provide the capital. Marx thought that the capitalist only supplies the money for an enterprise and the workers do all the rest. I wanted to show, through using the example of Trump, that no, the entrepreneur does a lot. The entrepreneur comes up with the idea for a business. The entrepreneur organizes the business. The entrepreneur takes all the risk. And finally, the entrepreneur very often, as in Trump's case, markets the business. So the Commodore Hotel was a rundown hotel, and Trump amazingly put together the whole deal for this hotel. He didn't have any money, so he got the banks involved. Then he had to redo the hotel, and he put this reflective glass on it so you could see in the hotel itself the monuments of New York reflected, if you will, on the building itself. So Trump has a genius for putting things together and also marketing them in a way that creates value. So he came off handsomely. He made a good profit, but so did the Hyatt chain, which managed the hotel. And this is a perfect example of taking something that's run down and broken down and making it fantastic. I mean, if you contrast Trump with some Antifa guy, the Antifa guy breaks windows, he knocks down monuments, he breaks things. He's essentially about destruction. Trump is essentially about building things.
You also address the issue of identity politics and ask this provocative question: should our politics be determined by our skin color or sexual organs? And you point to the example and interview Terrence K. Williams, a conservative black comedian. Tell us his background and how he went from being a Democrat to not just a Republican, but someone who professes love for Donald Trump.
Terrence is a young guy. I wouldn't say he's an educated guy. He's a very funny guy. He grew up in foster homes. His mother was a drug addict. So in some ways, he's a perfect candidate for the Democratic Party. He's a victim, if you will, and he's a genuine victim. But he realized the thinking of yourself as a victim is very destructive. It's demoralizing. It pulls you down. It makes you ultimately simply look for other people that you can be dependent on. And then, of course, you're captive to those people's interests and their agenda. So Terrence realized, if I build my own life, if I'm the architect of my own destiny, I'll probably come out ahead. And he has. So this is a guy who sort of is, in a sense, eligible to be a victim, but nevertheless chose to pursue happiness in the sort of classic sense. Now, the reason this identity politics business is important is because it's somehow become engrafted onto socialism. Classically, socialism is just about the rich and the poor. It's a class divide. Marx wanted to divide society between the working class, sort of exploited people, as he saw them, and then the capitalist class. Those were the exploiters. But the left today divides society not just into rich and poor, but also into black against white, and male against female, and straight against gay, and legal against illegal. So the left is all about the politics of division, and their goal of doing this is to create a sort of majority coalition of oppressed victim groups.
Rick Figueroa, an Hispanic conservative leader, was the youngest of eight, came from the barrio. His greatest aspiration at the time when he started out was a house with central heat and air. And he said he created that lane for himself through capitalism. What were some of the key elements that he gleaned from his mother, who had worked in a hospital kitchen for 36 years, that gave him a strong foundation?
So Rick Figueroa was somebody who grew up in the barrio, but is now a very successful entrepreneur and rancher. And from his mother, he got some very basic lessons about working hard, not depending on other people, not expecting things from other people, but helping where you can, getting married and staying married, raising godly kids. And these seem like very trite ideas, but Rick says that they're well established in the Hispanic community. When I told him that these seem to be sort of the principles of the Republican Party, he said, you know, they've been established in Latino communities long before the Republicans kind of embraced them. So I think what Rick is saying is that there's a natural fit between conservative principles and Latinos. And these are principles not just of individualism, but also of family and community and ultimately country and God.
We're talking with Dinesh D'Souza, author of The United States of Socialism and the new movie Trump Card. You can access the movie. You can rent it for $4, buy it for $15 online through the website TrumpCardTheMovie.com. It's on all kinds of platforms, video on demand, Apple, iTunes, Amazon Prime, Google, YouTube, Fandango, Vudu, Xfinity. You can see it on your tablet or your big screen TV or your phone. But it is absolutely worth every penny and more. TrumpCardTheMovie.com. In your exploration of how socialists have used these various identity groups to animate those groups toward support of socialism, you also look toward their advocacy for women, and it seems to be fundamentally all about abortion, doesn't it?
I think if you look at the Kavanaugh hearings, on the surface, that was about the Me Too movement, all these accusations against Kavanaugh. He did this and he did that. Now, we know that these accusations are bogus. Why? Because 5 minutes after Kavanaugh was confirmed, all the accusers went away. All the investigations stopped. All the media interest dissolved. So pretty clearly, in retrospect, it was all about a certain kind of theater, a kind of orchestrated assault to try to get rid of this guy. But why get rid of this guy? What was the fear about? Well, Christine Blasey Ford's own attorney said very clearly, she goes, you know, this is all about Roe versus Wade. If Kavanaugh overturns Roe versus Wade, we want to put a stigma on this guy. And that's partly what motivated Christine Ford to come forward with her accusation. So there you have it, kind of from the horse's mouth, that Roe versus Wade, that abortion, that's what this was all about from the beginning.
Your daughter Danielle has a forthcoming book entitled The Choice, The Abortion Divide in America. And she lays it out pretty clearly that in the Church of Gender Identity Politics, abortion really has become the ultimate sacrament.
It's out now, so you can get it. The beauty of having a young woman in her 20s talk about this issue is that Danielle approaches it in a language that, say, I wouldn't use. It's a very colloquial but very emotionally powerful language. So she'll point out, for example, look, everybody knows that a fetus is not a cluster of cells. She goes, many of my friends are of the age where they're getting married, they're getting pregnant. Just go on their Facebook page. Look at the way people talk about what's in the stomach. They'll say, oh, wow, family of three. Hey, look at the little guy's toes. So in other words, there is a common agreement. If you look at the 300 comments on Facebook, not just from the mom, but also from her friends, they all assume that there is a live human being, an independent being inside the womb. And so Danielle goes, only when you talk about the abortion debate, somehow the thing that we can see in the ultrasound, the heartbeat we can hear, it all disappears. And suddenly it's just an extension of the woman's body. And it's just a cluster of cells. And I think what she's trying to get at is how dishonest our political debate is around this critical issue.
There is a disturbing connection, Dinesh, between identity socialism with radical Islam. You talked with Alan Bender, a Canadian politician. What did you learn?
Well, Alan Bender is very influential in the Middle East. He's what is sometimes known as a fixer. He's hired by the Saudi royal family to arbitrate disputes within the family and so on. Well, Alan Bender was recruited by the nation of Qatar to be sort of in charge of their operations in America. And when he went to meet those guys, they told him that they were actually representing Iran. Qatar is funneling Iranian money into American politics. They're funding American think tanks. They're funding American journalists. And they're also funding American politicians like Ilhan Omar. So the idea here is we've been talking now in America for years about Russia collusion. And the typical evidence is, you know, seven Russians bought a Facebook ad for $200. Well, that's all trivial compared to Islamic intervention in American politics. And I don't mean Muslims organizing politically. I'm talking about radical Islamic regimes like Iran using intermediaries like Qatar to try to shape the elections and shape American politics. Their goal is nothing less to have the Ramadan prayers in the White House and to make America, if you will, unofficially, if not officially, a Muslim country.
All right, I want to unpack two things you said, and they were pretty shocking to me when I heard them as I watched this special screener of your film, Trump Card, and people can get access to it, get the DVD, rent it online for about $4. The DVD is only about $15. TrumpCardTheMovie.com. Alan Bender, the Canadian politician, documents that journalists are not just influenced by public policy in terms of supporting kind of a pro-Islamic worldview in their writing and being hostile, for example, to Israel, but they're literally making direct payments to these American journalists. I mean, this was shocking.
It's very shocking, and I happen to have the names of some of these journalists. I didn't put them in the movie in part because I just didn't want this to be an issue of lawsuits and this kind of thing. But what Bender basically says is that there are journalists high up. Alan Bender, the Canadian businessman, and by the way, this is a guy who happens to be a liberal. He's a friend of Justin Trudeau. He's connected with the Liberal Party. So he has no incentive, ultimately, to hurt the left. And yet, what he says is that radical Islamic regimes pay money to prominent American journalists in mainstream outlets. And they also pay money to American think tanks. And they directly fund politicians like Ilhan Omar. They groom them, they cultivate them. And one of the reasons for paying the media is they want to make sure that if scandals erupt around Ilhan Omar, scandals involving campaign finance reform, where she marries her brother, all kinds of shenanigans, these get covered up in the media because the media is also in the radical Islamic party.
He said that they squelched, the journalists that are being paid off by Qatar and Iran with direct payments, they have squelched six different scandals of Ilhan Omar, the Muslim congresswoman from Minnesota.
Ilhan Omar, in a sense, claims to be a quadruple victim of oppression. Why? Because she is a woman. She's also a Muslim. She is a person of color. And finally, she's from the desert. She wears a hijab. So for all these reasons, she sort of grabbed the bottom rung of the ladder. And that makes it very difficult for people to attack her. And it rallies the left to her defense.
You touched on something in your movie, Trump Card, Dinesh D'Souza, that I have wondered about for a long time. I had not been able to figure out why is it that so many Muslims who embrace a very strict understanding of sexuality are walking arm in arm with the sexually permissible left. You talk to an imam, Imam Tahidi, and he explains why.
This imam, who himself used to be an Islamic radical, his name is Muhammad Tahidi, he says that when he was a radical Muslim, he always voted left. He would never vote for Trump, and radical Muslims never vote for Trump. So I said, why? Isn't it odd, these strange bedfellows? What does radical Islam have in common with the left? And Tahidi says that they have a common enemy. And the enemy isn't just Trump, but it's also the Republicans, the conservatives, the Christians. And so what you have here is an alliance of two groups of people who have somewhat different agendas, but have the same ideological foe. And so then I asked him, what do these two sides provide for each other? And he said, look, the Muslims provide the vote. So the left wants the Muslims to be part of a sort of minority that delivers votes, and the Muslims deliver the votes. And in return, what they get from the left is political protection. If anybody attacks radical Islam, the left will jump in and say, you're an Islamophobe. Stop doing that. So the left offers radical Islam with a podium, a media, and protection.
Wow. We're going to take a quick time out. My guest is Dinesh D'Souza. He is the author of The United States of Socialism and the accompanying movie, Trump Card. It's available now on video on delivery. It's TrumpCardTheMovie.com, and you can get it for about $4 to rent, about $15 to buy it by DVD or to stream it and to have it in your possession. It's available through Apple, iTunes, Amazon Prime, Google, YouTube, Fandango, Vudu, and Xfinity. I'm Adam McManus in for Kevin Swanson, and when we return, we're going to ask Dinesh D'Souza about the absolute fascination that the socialists of America have with Norway and Sweden. We'll unpack that a little bit as well. We'll be back.
Ever since the creation of the Garden of Eden, Satan has been working his hardest to erase the knowledge of God and seduce the creatures made in God's image to think that they are the center of the universe. One look at today's society and you see his progress. Humanistic thought has inundated our culture, and we can trace its roots directly back to the classroom and the textbooks we're setting in front of our kids. That's why every Christian homeschool parent should have a curriculum that's not only rock solid academically, but most importantly will point students back to their Creator as the source of all wisdom and knowledge, and to Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior. If you've been struggling to find such a curriculum, look no further. Here at Generations, we've spent over 15 years developing our Christian discipleship curriculum to help Christian homeschool parents like you pass on the faith to your children by teaching a God-centered view of life and integrating the Bible into every lesson. Our goal is to not only help you meet your students' academic needs, but also to assist you in discipling your children for generations to come. So get started today with our Christian discipleship curriculum and watch your children marvel, learn, and mature as they embark on a God-focused learning adventure to discover more about the world around them and the one who made it all. You can learn more about our curriculum resources and pick up our newly released fifth grade curriculum pack today at generations.org/curriculum. That's generations.org/curriculum.
Welcome back to Generations Radio. I'm Adam McManus in for Kevin Swanson. My guest is Dinesh D'Souza, the author of The United States of Socialism. His new movie is Trump Card, and you can get it, you can stream it, you can buy it, you can get the DVD, especially before the election, and share it with your friends and family. Have people over to your house and watch it together at TrumpCardTheMovie.com. TrumpCardTheMovie.com. You can rent it for about $4. You can stream it for $14 or own the DVD for $15. Now, the left loves the countries of Norway and Sweden, and typically they are being mischaracterized as quote-unquote socialist countries, but that's not really accurate, is it?
The Scandinavian countries are capitalist in wealth creation, although socialist in wealth distribution. So they have corporate tax rates of around 20%, same as the United States. The Scandinavian countries, by and large, have no minimum wage. You can hire and fire people for any reason. With one exception, Norway, they don't have any wealth tax. They don't have any inheritance tax. One country, Finland, tried universal basic income, got rid of it. So the bottom line of it is that the Scandinavians do not kill the goose that lays the golden eggs. And even though they have an expansive welfare state, they impose the burden of the whole society. In other words, they don't demonize the rich. They don't try to rob Peter to pay Paul. They don't attack millionaires and billionaires. Instead, what they do is they make the rich pay, they make the middle class pay, and they make the poor pay. Their so-called value-added tax, which is a VAT, it's 25% on consumption, it falls heavier on the poor and middle class than it falls on the rich. So this is not a model that, as far as I can tell, anyone on the American left is trying to follow.
So where does Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez come from then when they're talking about the demonization of the 1% and it's not fair and they should have to pay their fair share, quote unquote, and all the rest of it?
Well, when the left keeps talking about Scandinavia, you just have to ask this question. When they go as political tourists to praise socialist countries, where do they go? Look at Bernie Sanders. He's actually part Scandinavian, but he's never been to Scandinavia. When he had to go for his honeymoon, he chose to go to Moscow. Look at Michael Moore. When Michael Moore made his movie Sicko and he wanted to talk about the wonders of socialist healthcare, he could have gone to Oslo or Copenhagen, but instead he went to Havana. He went to Cuba. And even today, all these Hollywood celebrities like Sean Penn and Oliver Stone and Danny Glover, where do they go? They go to Venezuela. They embrace Hugo Chavez, the former dictator, and they love that type of socialism. And in fact, when you look at Venezuelan socialism, my wife Debbie, by the way, is from Venezuela. When you look at Venezuelan socialism, it bears a very close resemblance to what the American left is trying to achieve.
Michael Moore, interestingly, you point out, actually went to a hospital reserved for tourists and very rich Cubans. It was hardly representative of what the average Cuban gets in terms of the so-called free health care.
All the socialist societies operate in a two-tier system. They have a kind of elite tier that's only for the socialists and typically for foreigners who can pay. And then they have a general run-of-the-mill hospitals, which are horrible, which are for the general population. So what Michael Moore did very cunningly is he chose one of the elite hospitals that is mainly for the Castro elite and then for foreign people who can pay, and he presented that as typical of socialist healthcare. It's not. That's not what the Cuban people experience. So interestingly, Michael Moore was sort of knowingly colluding with the Cuban regime to produce socialist propaganda.
How is it possible that a successful country like Venezuela, which interestingly President Trump acknowledged, I believe, in the second debate, had done so well, rich with resources, is the struggles of electricity blackouts and gas lines?
Venezuela, before it was socialist, was a free market capitalist society, an oil-rich society. It had a multi-party system. It's also very racially diverse, like the United States. When Hugo Chavez came in, he denied that he was a socialist. And he told Jorge Ramos, the journalist, he said, oh, no, I'm not going to nationalize companies. I'm going to welcome foreign investment. It took Hugo Chavez many years before he established socialism firmly in Venezuela. But he did it by demonizing the rich, by confiscating property, by expropriating businesses. Many successful entrepreneurs fled the country. Hugo Chavez took over the oil company called PDVSA and staffed it with socialist bureaucrats. They ran the oil company into the ground. It could barely produce oil anymore. And so the bottom line of it is this once rich society is now in ruins. Venezuela's gone from being a first world country to now being a third world country.
Dinesh, if Joe Biden becomes president, gun control is going to be the order of the day, and no doubt he'll lean on Beto O'Rourke from Texas to do it. Talk about your conversation with Andrew Pollack, whose daughter was tragically murdered at Parkland High School by Nick Cruz, and what policy led to that.
Andrew Pollack says that the problem was not the gun. It was the psycho kid who did the shooting, and the psycho kid was known to be a psycho. The cops had gone to his house dozens of times. He was a highly disturbed individual. He promised to be a school shooter. He made a video saying, "I'm going to be a school shooter." But they did nothing to him. Why? Because they had classified him as somehow mentally handicapped, and therefore he fell into a kind of a protected category. So the point here is that these schools have become extremely negligent about identifying very dangerous kids and, in a sense, removing them from the school system. This kid remained in the school system. He continued to make threats, and eventually he carried out his threats. Now, on top of this, you have school officials who did nothing to protect these kids. The school security officer did nothing. He goes and puts on his bulletproof vest, but he doesn't even go in the building. So had the teachers and some of the administrators been armed, had there been a better security system, they could have protected a lot of those lives that ended up being lost.
You examine Hollywood and talk to a black actor who apparently is a very lonely man because of his conservative convictions. I forget his name off the top of my head, but he said something very interesting about what animates the people at the top of Hollywood and why they are so hostile to conservative values. Tell us a little bit about that.
This is Isaiah Washington, who was one of the stars of the hit show Grey's Anatomy, very recognized and decorated actor. And he makes the point that a lot of the creative people in Hollywood, you know, Hollywood is an insular, a small community, very incestuous, so to speak. He says a lot of those people are gay. And they were raised ultimately in conservative communities, many of them in the South. And so their activism is a result of their rebellion against their roots. They're rebelling against their parents and their teachers and their small town pastors. And because they identify those people with repression, with rules, with don't do this and don't do that, and this is immoral, they identify breaking the rules and turning the tables and, in a sense, embracing a certain, you know, amoralism or even immorality as being a form of liberation.
I was intrigued by the phrase, Hollywood delivers the revenge of the hurt, H-U-R-T.
The revenge of the hurt. In other words, these are people who have become wounded through their experiences as children and in growing up, and now they're taking it out. What they do is they write scripts in which the villain is always some wicked entrepreneur or some patriarchal dad or some televangelist who's a secret member of the Ku Klux Klan. These are sort of cartoon scripts, but nevertheless, they are aimed at taking revenge on the people that these Hollywood types believe have wronged them.
I want to cover three final topics. One, the deep state. Two, religious freedom. And three, your ultimate conclusion. Dinesh D'Souza, my guest, author of The United States of Socialism, his movie, which I just saw and absolutely loved, Trump Card. You can get it. You can stream it at TrumpCardTheMovie.com. It's available video on demand through Apple iTunes, Amazon Prime, Google, YouTube, Fandango, Vudu, Xfinity. The cost to rent it, just $4. The cost to buy it and stream it, $14, or the DVD is about $15. So I urge you to do that. TrumpCardTheMovie.com. All right, the deep state. This is the IRS, the CIA, the DOJ. And you talked to a woman who headed up a group called True the Vote, T-R-U-E, True the Vote. What was the purpose of her group, and why did the deep state give her such a hard time?
So this woman runs an organization that tries to ensure voter integrity, that the people who are casting a vote are eligible to vote. And as soon as she basically put her organization together, she says an alphabet soup of federal agencies descended on her: audits, investigations, give me your membership list, give me lists of all your members, who's on your board, how many speeches have you given? What did you say? So the bottom line of it here is that a kind of harassment by the police agencies of government. Now, somebody is directing all this. obviously, these are the people who have corrupted the deep state. I had my own troubles with the Obama administration over a relatively minor campaign finance violation. They appointed a dozen FBI agents to go after me. You know, I was in front of a courtroom, United States of America versus Dinesh D'Souza. So what I realized is that my own case, which goes back to about 2013, was the preview of a lot of deep state harassment of other people, Carter Page and George Papadopoulos and Michael Flynn and even President Trump. I had a meeting my family did with President Trump last November, and he literally said, he goes, Dinesh, when I heard about your case, he goes, I knew it was bogus. And he goes, and now they're trying to do to me what they were doing to you. So Trump himself understood very clearly a connection between the deep state harassment of me and others and his own troubles at the hand of the deep state. We now know, of course, that the chief orchestrators of those troubles appear to be Hillary Clinton, the instigator, and Obama, the ringleader.
Why is the U.S. government being weaponized against its own citizens?
I think the simple answer is this, and that is that the left has become gangsterized. And the left has also realized that the right, the Republicans, the Christians, the conservatives, they are the party of the nice guys. So the left thinks, look, we can do all these shenanigans to you because we know that you won't do them to us. We can knock down your monuments. You'll never knock down our monuments. We can pack the court. Even if you control the government, you won't pack the court. We can use the deep state against you and lock you up. Even if you control the deep state, you wouldn't dream of locking us up. So I think this is a case where the left is exploiting the innocence of the conservatives in order to weaponize the state where they can and bend the rules against them.
And you believe this is what led to Donald Trump's impeachment?
Absolutely. Because, look, Trump was impeached for what? Essentially for raising a question about the corruption of the Bidens in the Ukraine. We now know for a fact, and I've seen the documents myself. We have all this in the movie, by the way, 300 pages of documents of monthly payments over 5 years, $83,000 a month to Hunter Biden. And we know from Hunter Biden's computer now and from his business partner that that money was being split with Joe Biden. Joe Biden is the so-called big guy referred to on the computer and on those emails. And Hunter Biden openly talks about having to share. He complains about having to share the loot with Pop.
You interviewed Peter Schweizer, who says, look, there's no disclosure requirements for family, only for the politician. So that's why so many around Joe Biden and his family, from brothers to sons, got wealthy from foreign interests, even though the family members weren't terribly well qualified for what they were being paid for.
Yeah, they weren't qualified at all. And Joe Biden knew that their qualification was the fact that they were related to him. They had the same last name. You know, the Clintons also were running a similar racket, but they were doing it through a foundation. Give money to my foundation, and I will give you foreign policy favors in return. Biden figured out that he could do it a different way. The Chinese have had a long-standing policy all across Asia. They apply this in Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand. And that is that if they want a favor from a politician, they start lavishing funds and money on the relatives of that politician. They enrich the families of these politicians, and they've noticed that that produces very good results. So Biden apparently figured this out, and he decided to get in on the racket.
What was it that Obama appointed Biden to do in 2014 before Hunter was given these checks?
Biden was the point man in a number of areas. Biden was the point man in Iraqi rebuilding, and one of Biden's brothers gets a massive contract, to build 100,000 homes in Iraq. Then Biden becomes the point man on Ukraine, and his son, Hunter Biden, starts getting almost $1 million a year from Burisma, a thoroughly corrupt Ukrainian oil company, even though Hunter Biden has no experience in energy, nor does he have any experience in Ukraine. And so Biden's been cashing in everywhere. In China, they got deals from the Chinese government, in Costa Rica, in Jamaica. So this is a worldwide racket. Now look, Joe Biden's been in politics for 47 years. He's been making a government salary, and yet he has multiple homes, private planes, domestic staff, all the perquisites of the super rich. How could he afford that? The simple answer is he's got to be taking money on the side, and now we know he is.
But the media is virtually ignoring it, except for Fox News and conservative talk radio.
Yes, the media, ultimately, I'm afraid to say, is not even a real media. Because when we think of a media, we think of an independent group of journalists who are removed from the government, who are captive to no side, who apply a critical lens to the government, who share with the American people needed and vital information so the American people can make up their own mind. It's once you spell out these criteria that you realize we don't have a mainstream media in that sense. These people are fakes. They have media badges, but they're not real journalists. I think we've got to start looking at the media as a kind of communications wing of the socialist left, or the communications wing of the Democratic National Committee.
Wow. Dinesh D'Souza, final issue here that you raise in your movie, Trump Card, and I hope people will go to TrumpCardTheMovie.com, where they can stream it for rent for $4, buy it for $14 to stream, or get the DVD for $15. Again, that's TrumpCardTheMovie.com. Religious freedom. You talked to Kelly Shackelford of First Liberty. He said something that really got my attention. He said, the one thing that a totalitarian regime cannot allow is citizens with a higher allegiance to something other than the government.
In a way, Shackelford here is echoing the writer George Orwell and many others who have pointed out that what socialists really want is the naked, shivering individual and then the all-powerful state, because the state can easily dominate that kind of a helpless person. And all the so-called intermediate associations of family and civic groups, they come in the way. And that's why we can resolve a mystery. Why do socialist governments care if you belong to the Boy Scouts? Why do they care if you are involved in your little league? Why do they care if you want to be part of a sports team? And the answer is they want to dominate all those institutions as well. Look at the way that the left, which controls academia, they control the media, they control Hollywood. You'd think they wouldn't want the NFL or the NBA. Who cares about a bunch of people who are dribbling a ball or run with the ball? But the answer is they want those institutions too. So the church is an enemy of the socialist state. It was an enemy of the socialist state in Hitler's Germany. That was the National Socialist Party. It was an enemy in Stalin's Russia. And so all these socialist regimes try ultimately to weaken, and if they can, to crush religious liberty.
We're all familiar with the Colorado baker who was through the Colorado Commission. They were hoping they could force him to bake a cake celebrating a homosexual faux marriage in a wedding. He refused to, and of course was just vilified for it. I love what Kelly Shackelford said by way of comparison, because I think it puts it plainly for all to see how naked the government on the left is in terms of wanting to force people to violate their convictions. And he asked this rhetorical question: do you really want the government to penalize a black baker because he will not bake a cake for a KKK rally?
It gets to the heart of the issue, which is, do you want to force people to say things that they don't want to say? I mean, remember this guy, Jack Phillips, in his bakery, anybody can buy a cake. Anybody can buy anything that he has. He's not saying that his goods are out of bounds for gays. He's simply saying that if you're going to have a gay wedding and you want him, Jack Phillips, to provide a message that endorses the gay wedding, that's something he's not willing to do. Go to some other baker across the street who would do that. But see, the reason that they're suing him is they want to force him. The reason is they don't just want to scare him. They want to scare everybody else. They want people to realize that if you don't cooperate with the left, if you don't bow down, if you will, to the gods of the socialist state, we can terrorize you. We can make your life miserable. And even if you go to the Supreme Court and you win, we'll sue you again. So this is the way in which the left goes after people. I mean, look at the regime of intolerance they've established across this country right now. Before the election, people are being thrown off digital media. People are being fired because they've said the wrong thing. So this fulfills George Orwell's prophecy that socialism, even democratic socialism, in the end always pushes in the direction of tyranny.
You conclude with this wonderful scene that you recreated of Abraham Lincoln on a train ride. describing him as a moderate man, but that the Democrat Party in the 1850s had become gangsterized, and the Confederates had passed an order that every black Union soldier who was captured would be executed, a direct violation of all rules of engagement. Tell us about the order, the executive order that Abraham Lincoln signed July 30th, 1863, and why that was important.
So on that date, Lincoln signed what he called the Order of Retaliation. He said, for every black Union soldier executed by the Confederacy, one Confederate captive will be shot. Now, this is on the face of it shocking. It's not something well known about Lincoln. I put it in the movie and I recreated the scene. Why? Because I wanted to show that Lincoln realized that when a moderate man is in an immoderate situation, he's got to get tough. He's got to do things differently. Lincoln realized that as far as the Confederates were concerned, he sort of had to do to them what they were doing to him. Otherwise, they would never stop. And I think that this is actually a valuable lesson for the Republican Party today. It needs to get tough. It needs to hold the deep state to account. Now, obviously, this is going to be an agenda for Trump's second term. Trump didn't even control his own Justice Department for much of the first term. But in the second term, he's got to show that these guys like Comey and Clapper and Strzok and Page, they're not above the law. They don't get to weaponize the government against political dissidents and political opponents. So I think it's time for a new Republican Party, one that adheres to the old principles, but recognizes that you've got to be a little bit tough to get those principles implemented and to block the gangsterism of the other side.
Speaking of getting tough, you had a fascinating clip of yourself speaking before an audience in which you said Reagan lived in a different time and a different tone was appropriate. If Trump appears to be a mud wrestler, it's not because he created all this chaos and division. It created him. Tell us about that.
I think that that's manifestly true. Republicans nominated sort of one Boy Scout after another, you know, George H.W. Bush and Mitt Romney and Bob Dole and John McCain. And look how those guys got beaten to a pulp. So I think ultimately the Republicans concluded, look, the other side has become gangsterized. We need to have a guy who's up to the occasion, a tough guy who can fight on our side. That's sort of how we got Trump. Now, in the Reagan era, it was a Cold War against a foreign opponent. But now I argue we are in a cold civil war against a domestic opponent. So our situation is actually much closer to Lincoln's than it is to Reagan. You know, people debate the Civil War. They go, how did we get a civil war? Was it really about slavery? Well, regardless of whether it was about slavery or not, we know that what triggered the Civil War is simple. A Republican won a lawful election. He got a lawful electoral majority, and the other side went berserk and threatened to bust up the whole country. Well, that is eerily similar with the situation that we've been facing and living with for the past few years.
Would you mind closing us with a prayer for this country?
Certainly. Dear Lord, America has always been a providential nation, by which I mean that Americans from the beginning, the founders and Lincoln and Reagan, saw America as having God's hand on it. Not that God plays favorites so that God is on America's side, but America wants to be on God's side. And I think many of our troubles are because we as Americans have fallen away, if you will, from the faith. And so we call on you, Lord, to bless this country, to heal the land, to help us get back on track. If we need a third great awakening, help us have that in this country so we can all enjoy the blessings of freedom, the blessings of liberty, and the true liberty that is found only in allegiance to you. Amen.
Amen. Dinesh D'Souza has been my guest. Get his book, The United States of Socialism. Watch his movie through the website TrumpCardTheMovie.com. Again, $4 to rent, $14 to stream. The DVD is $15. They have platforms through Apple, iTunes, Amazon Prime, Google, YouTube, Fandango, Vudu, Xfinity. You can watch it on any device from your phone to a big screen TV. TrumpCardTheMovie.com. Thank you, Dinesh D'Souza, so much for your time. This has been thoroughly enlightening.
It's my pleasure.
I'd love to get your feedback about my conversation that you just heard with Dinesh D'Souza. Send me an email to adam@theworldview.com. That's adam at theworldview.com. I'm Adam McManus, filling in today for Kevin Swanson as we lay down a vision for the next generation.